Welcome to the third installment of Match Volume. Third time's a charm, right? I'm your host, Emily Rose Raboy. Here on Match Volume, we talk to people you might never get the chance to meet otherwise. So turn up that volume and let's start the show. In today's program, we'll be talking to a former death row inmate turned artist and an aspiring Olympian. But first, we're going to start off today's show by playing a little game. It's called Guess the Film Score. Ready? Yep, that's from USC alum George Lucas's beloved Star Wars. Some of the best film scores become part of pop culture and pop up in our everyday lives. Film soundtracks are the reason I cannot watch Hitchcock films. The orchestration is brilliant, but it completely terrifies me. I'm serious, I get nightmares. I could watch Psycho if I could just mute it, but then Psycho wouldn't be Psycho without the music and the ee. Joshua Chang sat down with Dave Sloniker, an orchestrator, conductor, and composer for film and television. Dave has done orchestration for such fan favorites as Spider-Man, Star Trek Voyager, 50 Shades of Grey, and Avengers Age of Ultron. Dave recently expanded his musical career by creating the Dave Sloniker Big Band. He has found great success in and out of cinema and was nominated for a Grammy for Best Large Jazz Ensemble Album in 2013 for his first album, Entrada. A note for you non-music aficionados, when Dave mentions charts, he is referring to sheet music.
Now, what do you think is the problem when it comes to composing a big band tune, especially now when the improvisational aspect, the individual aspect of the performer is more emphasized in jazz? How do you incorporate that with the more ensemble-like, organized, pre-written form of playing?
Well, that is the challenge, because you can oftentimes overwrite and it becomes nothing but a bunch of guys or women playing a chart, or you can start with the concept that you're going to build this a chart around one or two soloists, and perhaps you try to write figures or melodies or interludes that are trying to surprise the listener. And I think that's how a jazz composer can approach the idea of writing a chart, maintaining that air of surprise and improvisatory feeling, which is, to me, the essence of jazz.
Now, without doubt, your big band, Dave Sloniker Big Band, has a great number of very prominent personalities, like Peter Erskine or even Wayne Bergeson. And do you write your charts in mind of their particular style and try to tailor to their solo performances?
Well, I try to write a chart with some of the people that are in the band in mind. What would Woody Shaw, how would he approach this? So there's a sort of a archetype, and then you find who might best perform that, because you don't always know who's going to play your charts anymore. With regard to the musicians in my band, they're very busy, they play in other bands, so I'm trying to compose with them in mind, but it's not always possible that you will get them.
So, about your album, Dave, Entrada, let's talk about one of your tunes, Timelessness, and let's talk about your specific work, your technique, and your perspective into coming about that particular composition.
Well, Timelessness actually is a good example of my approach to improvisation and building in the freedom of a small group into a big band, because it begins just with the quartet. It begins with piano, bass, drums, and tenor sax. The band is playing backgrounds. And then at some point, the band has to make a comment on the tune. I think that's, if someone is coming to see your big band, at some point they want to hear everybody play. And so at that point, that's almost, I consider the band almost the fifth horn. So it begins with rhythm section with the melody and tenor sax, and then at some point there's a shout chorus, comes the climax of the tune with the big band statement, and then it goes out to the end.
If we could talk about your other side of the career beyond your jazz career and your big band, but your very impressive TV and film career, do you almost see yourselves in two different identities? The Dave Sloniker, the jazz composer, and the Dave Sloniker who writes for TV and film, or do you see a convergence of the two?
That's an interesting question, because any part of show business, you can get typecast. And yet, whether you're an actor or a director, or in my case, a composer, you can do many things. And that actually was what drew me to Los Angeles, is the idea that you could be. You know, when I was growing up in Pittsburgh, I'd be listening to Oliver Nelson, big band, Quincy Jones, and then I'd see, well, Quincy Jones was doing Ironside, and Oliver Nelson was doing all these shows. I always felt that coming to Los Angeles would provide the chance to do these many things, because I loved writing for orchestra, but I also loved writing for jazz. And it's not hard for me to change horses, but I think it is hard for some people to realize what you can do.
And obviously with such a wide range of films, I'm guessing the demands for the individual's orchestration would be very different. Is there an opportunity for you, being an orchestrator, to almost put in that little personal flair into it? If we hear the orchestration of Avengers and we hear that for, let's say, Hellboy, can we hear that little style of Dave Sloniker? Is that possible in doing film and TV work?
If you're an orchestrator, I don't think that's your job. Specifically, when you orchestrate in Hollywood, your job is to bring to life the composer's music. And the only thing that I might say comes out that's mine is hopefully the professionalism of it working. And the aim is always to make it recorded on the first take. That's always my aim. So you want to be known as a good craftsman.
All right. So once again, thank you so much. This is Joshua Chang from Annenberg Radio News. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
We go from emotionally moving film scores and jazz music to an emotional true story about a wrongfully accused man on death row, Ndoume Olatunsani. He was released from prison in 2012 due to lack of evidence. Ndoume talks with Rasha Ali about his 28 years in prison. During those years, Ndoume found a passion for painting. His colorful paintings depict African women, landscapes, and culture, and they were inspired by his mother.
My name is Ndoume Olatunsani. I spent 28 years in prison, and 20 of them was on Tennessee's death row for a crime that I ain't commit.
What were you convicted of?
I was actually convicted of first-degree murder and a robbery charge that happened in Memphis, Tennessee, actually. And the ironic thing about my situation is that, like I said, I was born and raised in St. Louis, Missouri, and had never even been to the state of Tennessee, and certainly not in the city of Memphis, before I was actually taken down there and put on trial for it and ultimately convicted and sentenced to death for it.
What was going on through your mind when you found out that you were put on trial for a crime that you didn't commit?
I really wasn't really concerned about it, because it was like, even though it was certainly a serious thing, but I know that I ain't have no involvement in it, didn't know nothing about it. So it wasn't like I was tearing down the police doors, you know, trying to figure out from what you want to talk to me about this particular crime.
Do you think having an all-white jury had anything to do with your conviction?
Oh, ain't no question about it. In case the prosecutor used each and every one of their preemptory strikes to get rid of all the black potential jurors, and left me with an all-white jury. And that made a difference. It really did.
Did you accept your sentence and just kind of be like, okay, this is what it is and this is what's going to happen? Or did you fight back?
I never laid down. So no, I never accepted that.
So the whole time you were on death row, you knew that you were going to get out?
Yeah, always. Certainly there were, you know, moments when of despair. And I found freedom. I found freedom and peace and happiness sitting in a 4 by 9 foot cell, I was able to find this peace, and come to this realization that, people are always looking outside themselves for something to, make them whole, or, somehow it's something outside of us that's going to make us happy with ourselves or make us better or whatever the case is. And the truth is, it's really not. I mean, we have everything inside of us that we actually need to be everything that, flares to our fullest potential.
How are you able to keep that hope alive?
A lot of it I attribute to my mom. She's was such a strong and amazing woman. And one of the things that happened a couple of years into my imprisonment, my mom was actually killed in a car accident along with a niece of mine. I mean, that just kind of broke me. I was already kind of low. I'm sitting where I was. But when that happened, I was like, I can't be hurt no more. The last time I seen my mom, which was almost a year before that this thing happened to her and my niece, as she was going out of the visiting room, I just jokingly said to her, "Oh, girl, I wouldn't know what to do if I ain't have you in my life." And she looked back in the same light and said, "Oh, yeah, you're going to know exactly what to do when the time comes." Of course, neither one of us knew that would be the last time we would actually physically see each other. 3 days after this, I get this news about her. I'm laying down, sleeping, trying to sleep away this pain. She came to me in this dream, as clear as we sitting here, and the only thing she said was, "Get up." And when she said it, I jumped straight up.
What was it like when you got out of prison and your mom wasn't there and she wasn't able to enjoy your freedom with you?
Right. Man, it was such a... that's really one of the sad, kind of sad points, in my story. I mean, I'm such a fortunate person. I really am. That's really was the sour, still is kind of this sour, aspect of, what's happening for me in life now, that she wasn't actually around to actually, be there.
Most people in prison kind of pick up a hobby or do something to pass along the time.
Right.
So being on death row, I mean, passing the time only leads to being executed. So
right.
What did you, was time even relevant to you while you were in there?
I mean, I sit here with a watch on now, but I was one of them people that while I was sitting in prison, I mean, I didn't even keep a calendar, in my cell, and certainly didn't have a watch because none of that stuff really mattered. The time was kind of irrelevant. I guess over the period of time that I was locked up, I'm sure I've read over a couple of thousand books or more. That one of the things that I did, I started painting while I was in prison. Became an artist, and before my mom passed away, I had this guy that was on death row with me to do this portrait of me. Long story short, when he did it, didn't look nothing like me, and I'm thinking, but I still had to pay him. And so I'm thinking the whole time I'm looking at this, man, I could have did a better job and kept my money. And at that point, it was like, okay, the only person stopping me from actually doing it is myself, because it ain't like I ain't had the time. So I actually started drawing and became a fairly accomplished artist. And so that allowed for, art in a lot of ways saved my life. It really did.
Okay, so you spent 23 hours a day in your cell and 28 years of your life in prison.
Right.
How do you come out with such peace and happiness?
I feel like I'm such a fortunate person. And and even though that I wouldn't have never chose what happened to me, what I vowed was that in spite of what was actually happening to me, I would not let that confinement define who I was and how I was going to, just kind of deal in life. Because like I said, I began to understand that if I'm happy or not happy, then it ain't because of what somebody else is actually doing. It's actually because of how I'm actually dealing with it.
That was Rasha Ali talking with Ndume Olatushani. You can see Ndume's art at the Windows on Death Row art exhibit at USC Annenberg until December 18th. Next up, we'll hear from someone who has also found a passion in an unexpected place. Daniel Tran talked with aspiring Olympian Nate Koch. Nate developed a love for running in fourth grade and successfully competed in decathlons throughout high school and college. Nate excelled in track and field despite a series of injuries. He realized he couldn't reach his Olympic dreams as a track athlete, so Nate started looking for a new path to the Summer Games. He found it in the velodrome. He's hoping to cycle his way into the 2016 Olympics in Rio.
What sport are you participating in?
It's track cycling on the velodrome.
Gotcha. I know you're working towards Rio 2016 mm-hmm. with the Olympics. Where are you standing now in that goal?
It is constantly changing and evolving, and the world is broken up into sections for qualification points. And so you have to race at certain races in order to earn points for your country. And then once your country earns those points, then you have a spot for the country. Then you have to earn your own spot. So right now we're in the stage of still earning points for our country. And that depends on how other countries are doing, good or bad. And so it's still a work in progress.
Gotcha. What made you decide to go into track cycling?
Well, I was a decathlete and I ran track and field for 15 years. And after ACL replacement, meniscus surgery, several stress fractures, I ruptured my plantar fascia. I tore a ligament in my elbow. I was just beat to crap after being a decathlete. And so I was looking for something to rehab, basically. And so I rode the bike during rehab, and then as soon as I kind of figured out, like, you know what, like, I can't reach my Olympic goal as a track and field athlete, what's another sport I could maybe take a shot at? And having the only indoor Olympic velodrome in America 15 minutes away from me, which is in Carson, I figured that would probably be a good go. I know how to ride a bike. I'm good at going in circles and see what happens. I didn't even know what a velodrome was until about 6 years ago. So yeah, lots change, and I would have never thought I would be racing bikes.
Now, I know that the two sports, they're not all that related, but was it a struggle at first for you to make that transition from being a decathlete to a cyclist?
Yeah, so it was just different. I mean, sprinting and track and field, it's all body weight, and you're going from a standstill. And so that's what I was using. And then sprinting on a bike, you're pushing a gear, and you have to do it fast and explosive. So it's like doing sets of squats, a lot of them, and fast. And so it's almost more of an endurance sprint, where track and field is like a pure sprint. So it took some body adaptation, and then just general knowledge of learning. Being a newbie coming into the sport, I had a lot to learn. So, and I still do.
How comfortable are you racing a bike now?
Now I'm fine. it's taken a couple of years. I mean, I just basically finished my fifth year of riding a bike racing. I still have lots to learn, but I mean, I've rubbed shoulders with the best guys in the world and Olympic champions and whatever else. And sometimes I can compete with them, and sometimes I can just race next to them. And so there's a little bit difference, but I feel good about it. I feel like I'm moving in the right direction still.
What made you decide to go into track or cycling instead of, you know, the other big team sports like football, basketball? I mean, you're obviously a very good athlete. So what made you decide to go into, you know, the track or yeah. cycling?
I didn't do well with the team sports. Like I like taking all the pressure on myself and trusting in myself and making it happen that way. And then there's just a lot of politics with who starts and whatever else. And so I figured, you know what, if I'm the fastest, there's a time and everybody knows Nate's the fastest. So it's easy to accept if you're the best, or if you're not the best, you know what you got to do to get there.
You're in the process of becoming an Olympian. Did you always want to be an Olympian?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, the Olympics have been a big part of my family. Basically, we didn't have cable growing up. We had a TV and we could watch movies, and that was exciting. But every 4 years, we'd get the cable turned on to watch the Olympics. And so it's something I obviously grew up with and just had those goals. And track and field, growing up as a track and field athlete, the Olympics are the end-all be-all. Like, that is what you train for. And so that's basically where I set my goal. I wasn't going to set it to be a varsity athlete or win this race, like small stuff. Like, I figured if I was going to make a goal, set the best one, biggest one possible, try and reach it.
think that's all the time we have left. Thank you for so much for coming, Nate.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, this is Daniel Tran from Annenberg Radio News. Just interviewed Nate Koch, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Match Volume. The producer is Megan Coyle. Match Volume is a podcast of Annenberg Radio News and the Media Center at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Emily Rose Ruboy. Thanks for listening.